Good morning. We have only one case set for argument this morning. That is United States v. Hennis. Both sides have been allotted 60 minutes to argue. Is the appellant prepared to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Tim Burrows, and I'm joined by Mr. Jonathan Potter and Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Carrier, and together we represent the appellant, Timothy Hennis. Mr. Chief Judge, we'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
On you?
For us.
Okay. Together?
Yes, as a team.
Okay. Yes, granted.
What the Army seeks to preserve in this court-martial is something Americans have never seen, heard, or condoned before. It is a court-martial imposing the death penalty on an individual who had been acquitted by a civilian jury decades before and imposed after he had left active service, retired, and returned to civilian life. It is unprecedented. It is also unlawful, unjust, and unfair. Unlawful in that this court-martial lacked jurisdiction. Unjust in that this court-martial denied Timothy Hennis a complete defense. And unfair in that this court-martial subjected Timothy Hennis to a panel that was impaired by actual and implied bias. This court should dismiss this case. Now, in a few minutes, Mr. Potter is going to address exactly why this was an unjust denial of his right to present a complete defense and why it was an unfair panel to be tried before. But I'd like to begin with something that eclipses both of their serious issues, and that is the question of jurisdiction. The government has failed to establish it for the following three reasons. Number one, the break in Timothy Hennis' military service precluded any jurisdiction over these allegations. Number two, this is not a case arising in the land and naval forces. It arose in the state of North Carolina, and it is beyond the subject matter jurisdiction of a capital court-martial. And number three, the government has failed to perfect personal jurisdiction over Timothy Hennis. Now, of these three independent reasons for finding a failure to establish jurisdiction, the narrowest and the most expedient way to address them is the first assignment of error, namely the break in service. On 12 June 1989, the Army discharged Timothy Hennis nearly 3 years after he had completed his service obligation. That is a break in service and a break in jurisdiction. The government lost any claim to jurisdiction at that point.
Counsel, may I ask you a question about that? We've recently had a number of cases that have suggested that the question of when you're out of the Army is quite complicated and that there are a number of factors that must be considered, including not only when did you get your DD-214, but also have you cleared the post, have you received your final accounting of pay, issues of reason and policy not justify the conclusion that you're still in the Army. My question is this: how are we so certain that he was actually out of the Army for one day just because his service ended and got his DD-214 on that one day?
Your Honor, I have three responses to your question. First, I think we start with United States versus Clardy, which is good law, and it reflects law that preceded it. In that case, if there is a discharge occurring after the service obligation has been met, that is a discharge. That is a break. And this case fits squarely within Clardy. And that leads to my second point, which is this break in service is the law of the case. The Army Court found quite reasonably and correctly that the facts supported a break in service. The government has not challenged that on this appeal, and so we say that is the law of the case. There's no reason to depart from that prudential doctrine here. And to do so, we submit, would be to reverse Clardy, which, again, is good law and should remain under stare decisis. And my third response to that is, if there are any remaining questions about the facts, and I submit there are not, It's on the government to demonstrate them. They have the burden of proof when it comes to this question.
Is it your position, counsel, that the break in service was not one day, but rather once the convening authority took the action that they did with respect to the unauthorized act, the unauthorized absence period when he was confined in North Carolina, that his ETS was actually August 1986?
Yes, Your Honor.
There was a three-year break in service?
Approximately, yes, Your Honor.
It was cured then, or it was then he reenlisted and began a new service?
Yes. His service obligation expired in August of 1986, and it's only some 3 years later that the Army discharged him. The fact that he reenlisted the next day is immaterial, and Clardy makes that clear.
If he had not reenlisted on the next day, would he be subject to Article 3 Alpha? If he had not reenlisted and but rather had just left active duty and the evidence had been discovered decades later and the Army had said, well, you fall under the terms of Article 3 Alpha, would that have been permissible?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Is that Toth?
Sorry.
Is that actual Toth?
Exactly, Your Honor, yeah. I think Toth makes that proposition very clear. And the fact that he chose to reenlist, that he chose to serve, should not be kind of cause to perform something that the Supreme Court has already said is beyond the authority of a court-martial. Break in service is the dispositive issue in this case, and that is the simplest way to address what is an extremely complex case otherwise. Now, the government submits that Article 3A, as it applies to this case, nevertheless grants them authority to revive this jurisdiction lost. And they rely on the phrase in Article 3A that it returns if allegations such as these cannot be tried in any other United States forum. In order to accept that reading of Article 3A, this court would have to embrace an absurdity and inconsistency in its reading. The absurdity is clear. The government, in the bluntest terms, is arguing that Timothy Hennis's protection against successive prosecutions is what enables the government to perform a successive prosecution. The Double Jeopardy Clause at times may get out of the way, but it has never been the source for performing a successive prosecution. Pending any questions on this matter, I'd like to turn to some of the other jurisdictional questions. Obviously, this break in service is dispositive, but if the court looks beyond it, there are other jurisdictional problems presented here. The first one I'd like to address after that would be the constitutional question, and this court previously acknowledged that this is an interesting an open question, and it is squarely presented in this case. The Fifth Amendment guarantees the protection of grand jury indictment to anyone, unless the case is one arising in the land and naval forces. This is not one arising in the land and naval forces. Historically, both before the founding of our nation and well after it, capital murder was not an offense that could be tried at court-martial. It was outside the realm of military justice, and for good reason. The founders at that time recognized the importance of grand and pettigrew protections, and the last thing they wanted is for these protections to be waved away in the most serious and grave cases.
Okay. So what precedents are there other than arguably O'Callaghan for that assertion?
I think the greatest precedent, Your Honor, is the two centuries of practice that we see.
I'm fully aware of the two centuries of practice. I'm also aware of the fact that in 1950, the whole thing got overhauled. So once again, has the Supreme Court ever held that a case like this is not a case arising in the land and naval forces for the purposes of the Fifth Amendment?
It has not, Your Honor.
Okay. Has any other court ever held that?
This court did in United States versus Borries. I believe that's 1969, if I'm not mistaken, on the date. Now, that was under the O'Callaghan understanding.
That was under service connection.
It was.
It's really not apposite. But go ahead.
I think it is in the sense that this court, considering those facts, recognized that an individual's acquittal in a state court for what is an offense civilian in nature, triable by civilian authorities, is not something that is service-connected. Now, the service connection test is not what we're advocating for. We're advocating for a truer and more original understanding of arising the land and naval forces.
Counsel, given that Solario, the holding in Solario was fairly unequivocal as to what the basis for jurisdiction was in a court-martial, don't you think that those are questions that we are ill-equipped to basically deal with? I mean, we can't overrule or limit the Supreme Court's decision in Solario. However interesting the historical practice might be, I mean, that would be a question that if it came to that, if the case was affirmed here and you appealed to the Supreme Court, that you would need to raise to them, don't you think?
I agree with the concerns, Your Honor, although I would say, first, our reading of Solario is that it doesn't preclude the question at hand here. Solario did not involve a capital case. Its review of the historical case law was, I submit, was turning on non-capital, avowedly non-capital sources.
Did the court advert to capital litigation in any way in Solario?
They did not.
They did not.
Well, so, weren't some of the cases they cited capital cases?
Your Honor, to the best of my recollection, they were not. As I read Solario, the key phrase is that when looking at the general articles, or the precursor of Article 134, that courts martial from the time of the founding were able to try any offense that was prejudicial to good order and discipline or service discrediting, that was a crime not capital. And I think that's exactly what Justice Stevens was looking at when he wrote the concurrence in Loving and joined by four other justices.
But there, Justice Stevens was not a majority opinion, and at most he said it's an open question. So getting back to Judge Ryan's point, the Supreme Court has stated that the one factor to consider is the military status of the accused. What authority would we have to buck what the Supreme Court has stated?
Good question, Your Honor. And the way I would approach this is to say that this court's opinion would not be challenging Solario so much as saying this is its application in the capital context, and it does not reach these cases.
Well,
a case called PAC, United States versus PAC, within the last 10 years, where we were asked similarly to sort of tweak the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on children testifying via video conferencing, and we said there, you know, we're not the right people to ask to tweak the Supreme Court's case law, right? You need to ask them.
Certainly, and I guess it's a difference of
well, and the Supreme Court being silent in Solario on this, you seem to say that silence means, oh, well, the question's open. It seems to me that Solario, if anything, is a very clear holding of jurisdiction, and it's not open. Or they would have said so.
If the question wasn't presented to them, I believe that would have been dicta and beyond the case presented.
They have been known to engage in dicta.
Certainly they have, Your Honor.
Okay.
But when the question has been presented more squarely before this court, particularly United States versus Curtis, which was decided after Solario was issued, this court went through this analysis. It asked whether the crimes in Curtis were service-connected. Ultimately, it found that they were, and there was no question about it. Again, in Gray, when this court was presented with that question, it found that Gray's crimes were so clearly service-connected that this question is interesting but not fully raised. So at least in the past, this court has been willing to address this question. I think it is, of all the courts beneath the Supreme Court, it is the only one prepared and knowledgeable enough to answer this question. So I would submit that there is wisdom in doing so.
Mr. Burroughs, if we were to adopt your view, what would the test be for service connection? Would we go back to O'Callaghan's test and all the factors? And if so, how would that test apply here?
So O'Callaghan began with, you know, the Relford factors, and in the beginning they were, I think, quite close to the meaning of what arises in the land and naval forces. But with time, they departed. And that was part of the problem in Solario that the Supreme Court was trying to address, is that the test became unwieldy. So I would propose something much simpler, and that would certainly resolve this case, which is if the matter can be tried by non-military authorities, if a state can try this, the underlying gravamen of the case, then that issue, that does not arise in the land and naval forces. If it occurs overseas, it's clear. If it's on a military installation, it's clear. If it occurs off post within a state jurisdiction.
What if it's on an installation with concurrent jurisdiction?
Well, in that case, I think that would be a matter of comedy between branches of the federal government.
Well, no, you're talking in hard and fast jurisdictional terms, and then suddenly we veer off into comedy.
Well, then I can propose something even simpler.
Well, it seems to me that if you bring back the baggage of O'Callaghan, you've got to bring back the baggage of Relford and everything else that followed it. This is a case in which a member of the armed forces on active duty murdered the dependents of another member of the armed forces on active duty in immediate proximity to a military installation. I have serious doubts that that doesn't fit into Relford, but go on.
Again, I think Relford and the kind of antecedents, rather the precedents following it, they really diluted the meaning of the constitutional protection, which is arising in the land and naval forces. And that basic term is not service connection. There are countless things that could affect military service that could connect.
But we are talking about two different things now. We're talking about O'Callaghan service connection, and we're talking about the Fifth Amendment.
Yes,
are you only talking about the Fifth Amendment?
I am starting with the Fifth Amendment. I know O'Callaghan attempted to address this, but to be quite honest, I think the court opened it up more than it should be. I mean, the language
the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court. The plain language of the amendment is for cases arising in the land and naval forces. Arising is very clearly something originating in or resulting from. Not
they said much more than that, O'Callaghan. They dragged in all this baggage about how courts-martial are peculiarly incapable of enforcing civil rights or legal rights and so forth. It's not just, O'Callaghan wasn't just a Fifth Amendment case. There was a whole lot of other stuff there, which the Supreme Court then found they had to clean up in Relford and its progeny.
I agree, and I wouldn't advocate for a return to O'Callaghan. I would advocate for a return to the text of the amendment.
Well, then you're going to have to, it seems to me, ignore 70 years. You're talking historical terms. You're going to have to ignore 70 years of history.
And I think Solario, and if the court were, if that position is to be taken, that
or 70 years of history minus 69 to 87.
I think there are two centuries and then a British tradition preceding that, which would put these types of offenses, capital offenses that are common law offenses, clearly triable in state courts, addressable by...
You didn't mean to say common law crime, did you?
Of this nature, not a common law crime specifically, but murder as it's broadly understood.
Understood. Go ahead.
These offenses... The underlying question is whether justice is being served, and that is something civilian courts are more than capable of doing. And in doing so, in the most serious offenses where life hangs in the balance, it would seem to me that the framers never imagined that the right to a jury would be suspended, the right to a grand jury indictment, and some of the other ancillary constitutional protections that come with civilian process. We have a robust system of justice. I'm very proud to be part of it, but there are structural differences. That is why we have a separate military justice system, and presumably if we return to an original understanding of the Fifth Amendment and its impact on this narrow set of cases.
I want to go back to your first point in Toth. The Toth opinion stresses more than once that the person has been wholly separated from the service for months, years, or perhaps decades. Like, so there's a complete separation that isn't handled or dealt with underneath the statute, under Article 2. How do you square that with the situation that we have here, which is appellant, I mean, he was retired, right? I mean, he was retired, but he's in a status that's covered by Article 2. So discuss. How does that play into Article 3A and the Toth opinion?
So we have two important periods of separation. We have his discharge in 1989, which, again, marks more than roughly 3 years outside the service. He wasn't wearing a uniform for that entire period. So that would be the first and what I would say is the dispositive break. We need look no further. But in terms of his retirement, it certainly raises an interesting question. We have challenged the constitutionality of trying retirees at court-martial. I understand that's not a granted issue today, so I don't mean to veer into that. That could arguably reflect a break in service as well. But beyond that, I think our initial break is the most most direct means of addressing this question.
Major Burroughs, could I ask you a question about this break in service issue?
Yes, sir.
Now, your position appears to be, correct me if I'm wrong, that once his, while he was in the hands of civilian authorities, once his unauthorized absence time was ruled or deemed unavoidable, that he simply, the time remaining on his previous contract came to an end back in 1989, right? Back in 1986.
Yes, sir.
Right. So he's then serving beyond, if we accept the convening authority or the command's view that they have ruled that or deemed that period to be unavoidable, then after August of 86, he's serving beyond his initial term of service, right? What is his status then?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Your Honor. I would say at 1986, he has completed his service obligation.
Right.
He has a discharge after that. That discharge occurring after a completed service obligation is the definitive moment. And Clardy, that's what it proposes. Those two conditions, once met, equal a break.
No, I understand that, but I'm trying to understand, and maybe the government can help me out when they have their turn at the podium, but that period between, let's say, August of 86, and when he's actually acquitted and returns to duty, what is that?
Your Honor, I think it's...
other than serving beyond the end of your term of service.
Yeah, I mean, to call it service would be to overlook his status at that time. He was serving a prison sentence, not the military, pending his appeal, which was later granted, and it was found that initial conviction was unlawful.
But then when he's acquitted and released from civilian authorities, he's reassigned to a military organization for some brief period of time before the reenlistment occurs in 89. But I guess my question is, what is all that time between when he's between August of 86 and the time he gets out, and the time, what is it? I just don't know what that.
First answer, we don't know until the convening authority decides how to treat the time.
Yeah.
Your Honor, I think that that's the best way to resolve it, Judge Ryan. But it's an interesting question, but I would stress that Clardy sets it to the side. We don't have to answer it definitively. And, you know, the important thing here is that we have these two conditions met.
Right, I understand that. And then my last question would be, you're kind of relying on Hirschberg for the fact that there's been this break in service, that the reenlistment occurs after his term of service, and therefore is invalid, right? In short form?
Clardy, I think, is the best distillation. Hirschberg is also relevant to that question.
Right. You mentioned earlier there was a, this would yield, reviving the jurisdiction would yield an absurdity. But I didn't understand what you meant by that. What is the absurd result that you have in your mind?
The absurdity in the quickest distillation, Your Honor, is that the government says, well, Tim Hennis cannot be tried because he has been tried, and therefore we can try him. And it's confusing. It's purposefully confusing because the idea here is that we only have authority to revive this jurisdiction because the state of North Carolina has tried him, found him not guilty, and that is the only condition that allows us to now revive jurisdiction. So it is basically to take the double jeopardy protections the Constitution promises and to turn them into his own enemy, to turn them against him, to enable something that is not just absurd, but manifestly against the legislative intent, which this court has repeatedly recognized as being the purpose of Article III in addressing the Hirschberg scenario, which is understandable. In Hirschberg, we have a petty officer who is alleged to have committed some offenses overseas, so outside any U.S. jurisdiction. He could never be tried for those offenses, only in a court-martial. But his break in service prevented any court-martial from regaining jurisdiction. And this case comes out a matter of weeks before Congress begins debating the code. And as we go through the legislative history, it's clearly their fixation with Article 3A. And so the clear purpose there is to provide some form of last resort for cases that could otherwise never be tried. And here we have the exact opposite scenario. We have someone who was tried not once but twice in a state court for civilian matters, and the interests that Congress was attempting to preserve in 3A were vindicated by the state of North Carolina in 1989.
Why doesn't our analysis begin and end with the actual text, where it uses the word cannot? And the Supreme Court has said that the tense of words in statutes matter, and that can is present tense, so it's the present or in the future, not encompassing the past. So why doesn't our analysis just focus on that wording? The Congress could have used very different wording to cover the scenarios that you're offering today.
So I have three responses, Judge Olson. First, yes, we always begin with the plain language, but when it yields an absurd result, we have to step back and take a broader look. And that's, I think, a fundamental canon of construction that applies here. Secondly, the use of the present tense is quite common in statutes. In fact, we could look at any one of the punitive articles in the code itself, and it says someone who commits an offense shall be punished, as a court-martial may direct. Well, clearly they're not taking a literalist understanding there, because otherwise you could only punish somebody who is committing an offense in the middle of the court-martial. So this use of the present tense is, it's the most neutral rendering of a verb in English, and I think that's the reason why it was selected. And then the third point is what I would call the inconsistency problem here. So if we adopt the position that the Army Court and the government advocates for, to look at cannot in this very narrow, restricted sense, well, then we need to be narrow and restricted throughout and be quite literal throughout, even though, again, I don't think that's the best way to read it. But if you commit to literalism on this provision, then you have to recognize that Timothy Hennis can be tried in North Carolina. The state could indict him, and he could walk in and say, I waive my double jeopardy protections. And this is one of the other absurdities in the government's position.
But you're suggesting then that the state, knowing full well that they're barred by double jeopardy, that they're going to nonetheless drag someone to court for triple jeopardy.
I agree. I don't think this is a reasonable thing to do, but Again, this is the outcome.
I mean, that's an absurd result, right? You're talking about absurd results. I mean, that's an absurd hypothesis with all due respect.
And the point is well taken, Your Honor. I think this is what happens when we take that approach of constrained literalism on something that, you know, in light of all of the evidence here, we have the legislative intent, we have this court's understanding in Gallagher, United States versus Gallagher, for example, and just common sense that what they were aiming at was Hirschberg and ensuring some form of last resort. And that understanding is the only one that matches with the broader ethic of military justice, which is that we are working in a system that is limited. Every structure, every contour of jurisdiction is something that must be only that which is absolutely necessary for maintaining discipline in the active service, right? And I'm quoting Toth.
That's your Toth argument, right?
Yes.
Right. So, query, why you said that your first point was that it would be you reading the statute the way that the government proposes and that the CCA did leads to an absurd result. What exactly do you mean by that?
Again, the first absurdity that I encounter looking at this is the idea that double jeopardy is now the cause for bringing Timothy Hannis into another prosecution. So that's the first one. The second one is the literalist inconsistency problem where we say cannot is limited to this very specific time, but yet we're not going to treat cannot as recognizing that Timothy Hannis could, however, whatever the merits of that decision may be, but he could waive his protection, and it's not for the government to exercise it on his behalf to his detriment. Those are my two main concerns here. And again, the overarching presentation that the government wants is to expand jurisdiction beyond what the legislative history, and again, I submit common sense, would argue for. So it's an expansionist view, which is exactly what the Supreme Court counseled us not to do in matters of jurisdiction. And it's not just Toth, it's everything that follows it. So with that, I see my time is moving quickly. I want to briefly address the personal jurisdiction matter and then make sure that Mr. Potter has enough time as well. So with personal jurisdiction, I basically think the starting point here is what status was he tried in? What status was Timothy Hannis purportedly tried in? All of the paperwork in this case suggests that he was tried as someone called to active duty, and yet the government has repeatedly referenced his retired status as a basis. I submit you have to pick one or the other. You cannot be retired and active at the same time.
Why do they have to pick one or the other? If they're using a belt and suspenders approach, what is wrong with that?
They are mutually inconsistent concepts and statuses. If you are retired, you're retired. You're not active. If you are lawfully called to active service, well, then you're no longer retired. And so they have to choose.
Did he object?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did he object?
He did, Your Honor. He objected to his recall. And
he objected to his recall for this reason, or he simply objected because he didn't want to be tried?
He objected to it for every subsequent reason. The question of his status is that's the seed from which the entire court-martial has to germinate. And if there's a problem there, the government has a problem with everything. But
to build on Chief Judge Stuckey's point, did he specifically raise it in the context that you are right now saying there are two mutually exclusive concepts? Because I note that J1357, the trial counsel said, cited the fact that the longstanding legal authority to prosecute retired soldiers. So both of those things were out there at that time. Where in the record does it demonstrate that this argument that you're making right now was made before the military judge?
I'll agree that it was not presented this clearly before the trial court. Fortunately, however, this is a question of jurisdiction, which this court can review de novo.
Is it?
It is.
Is it? I'm not at all sure it is. Number one was a question of jurisdiction. This is, as Judge Olson points out, a suspenders and belt thing. He's tried as one or the other. The fact that they may have thrown around both, where does that deprive the government of jurisdiction?
Well, again, the The assumption that we're challenging is that you can be in both statuses.
No, I'm not saying you can be in both statuses. I'm saying where does what was done here deprive the government of jurisdiction?
The fact that he challenged his recall, everything in the court-martial.
No, he didn't. You admitted that he did not raise this below.
No, Your Honor. He did challenge his recall. And
let's not bandy words. He didn't want to be recalled. We agree on that. But he did not challenge this in the sense of challenging it as you're presenting it. You just admitted that, Judge Olson.
Okay, so to be clear, I don't think he made it abundantly clear to the military judge that there is a choice to be made. He challenged the recall. And to be clear, the assumption at the time was that he was being tried as someone called to active duty. The charge sheet says United States Army. It does not say United States Army retired. The orders purporting to call him say you are released from your retired status and brought back onto active duty. So the assumption and the nature of the discourse at that time would be focused on that issue. And I think in terms of trial procedure, you start with that, and if the military judge says, we're going to try you as a retiree now, well, then you make that challenge at that point.
Was there any detrimental reliance on the part of the accused?
Yes, Your Honor.
So?
And to be fair up front, I don't think that's needed for a jurisdictional question, but there was in this case. Number one, what strikes me as the most important thing, although there are more than one reason, is the presentation of the accused at this court-martial. He had retired several years before this trial took place. Obviously, as folks age, they no longer look like the airborne master sergeants that one would expect at Fort Bragg. And we know from trial experience in this court's own case law that the presentation of the accused can have a negative and detrimental effect to the course of the trial. And that is one area. Whether it was intentional or not, I won't speculate as to that. But it had an effect. Beyond that, there are the constraints that come with being brought back onto active duty, removed from one's home on the other end of the country, and forced to spend 3 years awaiting trial. Whereas if he was allowed to remain in his retired status, he could manage his time as he saw fit. He could do a number of things that were not subjecting him to active military control.
Major Burroughs, I know your time grows nigh here, but let's assume for the moment that personal jurisdiction is an issue we review de novo. Would we be constrained by the theory of reactivating him by the government? Seems to me that jurisdiction is not a tactical choice. It either exists or it does not exist. So if this court were reviewing the issue of jurisdiction de novo and we looked to a different provision, like A4, to determine that he was a retiree subject to the code, could we do that?
Their answer, I think, lies in my response to Judge Olson's question, which is that the court-martial was predicated on this idea, and a jurisdictional defect is something that affects the entire case. And so there is a difference between having Timothy Hennis sitting in a suit and tie, appearing as a retiree, and the panel members understanding that status, versus Timothy Hennis at his later stage in life.
But that has to do with the viewpoint from the appellant's point of view. What about the pure legal issue of whether we, as a court of law, looking at an issue of law, are we constrained by what the parties did below, if we are, in fact, reviewing de novo?
Yes, I think in this case, yes, because actions, foundational actions were taken.
Why would that constrain us if we're reviewing de novo? The only thing that would constrain us would be the facts that have been found in the record, wouldn't it?
So the constraint, Your Honor, would come in the fact that if this court were to say, well, there was not personal jurisdiction under Article 2A1, but it could have been achieved under Article 2A4, therefore this was lawful, the 2A4 court-martial is not what happened. And I think that's the disjunction reviewing this in that particular manner would lead to. So with that, I sense a brief lull in the storm, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Potter with your permission, sir.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Potter.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Jonathan Potter on behalf of Timothy Hennis. When this case should never have been tried by the Army, as you've already heard, but when it was tried, it was riddled with errors. I'd like to discuss two of those this morning. First, the military judge put his fingers on the scales of justice in this case and denied the defense a complete defense. Second, the military judge seated a biased panel. To my first issue, the putting the scales on the put his hand on the scales of justice. The military judge in this case denied a complete defense to Tim Hennis. How did he do that? He did it in two ways. First of all, he clearly violated Holmes v. South Carolina's principles in limiting the witnesses that the defense could call for a third-party defense. Second, he restricted the defense's ability to have expert assistance. It's clear that the defense wanted to present a third-party defense in this case. It was their defense. They consistently said it was their defense. They wanted to call W.H., who they wanted to claim was the perpetrator of the actual crime in this case, Mary Cranks, W.H.'s former girlfriend, and William Staley, W.H.'s roommate. They wanted to call those three witnesses to establish that W.H. actually was a perpetrator in this case, or could have been a perpetrator in this case. It isn't necessary to actually identify W.H. as the actual perpetrator. It's clear from Holmes, it's clear from Woolheater, this court's precedent, that it isn't necessary to establish that the individual is actually the actual perpetrator. It's important, though, that the defense be able to present that evidence of a third party possibly being responsible for the crime.
However, the military judge has the authority to not let in evidence that is too speculative, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So when we're dealing with Mr. Hill, what the defense was presenting was things such as the scratches on his face, the proximity where he lived, the van, and the fact that he moved shortly thereafter. But weren't all those points either individually or collectively quite speculative in terms of Mr. Hill's connection to this man?
Not any more than if you look at Woolheater, if you look at particularly Holmes, if you look at Espinoza from the Ninth Circuit, all of those cases, Espinoza is a demonstration of pure speculation on the part of the defense with some attachment to the person. In that case, she's caught with meth in her car coming across the border. She says she's a blind mule and says, it's my neighbor that packed my car. What does she have? She has the fact the neighbor says he's a prior convict for dealing drugs, the fact he's a neighbor, the fact that she parks her car on the street. The Ninth Circuit said that is relevant enough to bring in the third-party defense.
But she personally tied him to the offense that she was alleging, right? I mean, she personally was able to tie him with specificity to he's the one that did it, and these are the reasons I give. Here, in contradistinction, there was a military judge found. If the military judge had just rested on the DNA evidence, I think you would be right. But he didn't. He said, there's nothing that says puts this person in this house. There's nothing that puts this witness by these events.
But if you look at two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, if you look at Patrick Cohn's statement to the police, immediately his first statement, he described somebody with the physique of W.H., not of Timothy Hennis, who was 6'6", he's larger than me.
He said someone that was 5'7" or 5'8", but certainly no taller than 6 feet tall, and the witness that you wanted to call was 6'1".
Your Honor, that's Charlotte Kirby. Patrick Cohn says it was around 6 foot, 175 pounds, I believe, is the weight. He described somebody that fits the physique of W.H.
Does that mean that every person that is in that size range, you know, was going to be the Saudi?
Well, no, Your Honor. Then you add in the other factors. the scratches on the face.
Okay, but with the scratches on the face, the military judge specifically asked defense counsel at that time, what time frame are we talking about? And defense counsel said within months those scratches occurred.
He also said around that time. And if you look at Mary Crane's...
But the military judge asked for clarification. And what was presented to the military judge, whose work we're reviewing, what was presented to him was those scratches could have occurred within months of the murders.
Your Honor, the trial defense counsel said that. The proffer also included a statement by Mary Crane saying around that time. And she put a temporal limit on that. She had dated William Hill. They broke up right before the murder.
But the fingernail scrapings of the victim, they did not test positive for Mr. Hill.
Your Honor, they didn't test positive for anybody. They didn't test positive for Timothy Ennis, if we use the term positive. They couldn't include anybody. Now, it's important to remember that Timothy Ennis went to PT the next morning after the murders in this case and had not a scratch on him. That crime scene was violent. There was, scratches had to be inflicted on somebody because there was skin under the fingernails of the victims. There was no mark on Tim Ennis, and he was in PT clothes.
But getting back to the issue that you're trying to address here, where should we say that the military judge got this wrong?
In his finding says, first of all, the DNA excludes WH. Well, that pushes this case right into the Holmes. He's relying on that scientific evidence. The other issue is he is just purely incorrect as a matter of fact regarding the description of the individual. Yeah, Charlotte Kirby describes somebody 5'6", to 5'8", to 5'9", of medium build. But Patrick Cohn, in his statement, after his first statement, describes somebody shorter than him, somebody 6'1", and somebody around 175 pounds.
Patrick Cohn was called at trial, right?
Yes.
And presumably he was cross-examined on the disjunction between what he described and what appellant looked like?
Precisely, Your Honor, but it was for the military judge to allow the defense to bring in their third-party evidence to counter that, to say, look, here is WH, who meets the description of who Patrick Cohn described leaving that house that night, not somebody that's 4 or 5 inches taller than Patrick Cohn, who was 6'2".
So you're saying the military judge was obligated to have a trial within a trial, that you're not only bringing in Mr. Hill, you have to bring in all these other witnesses. Isn't that what gives the military judge the authority not to pursue evidence that is too speculative?
Your Honor, I wouldn't say it's a trial in a trial. One part of the trial is the government's case. The other part of the trial is the defense's case. That's what we're asking for. The trial in a trial, we do have trials in a trial. It is allow the government to put on their case, and then you allow the defense to put on their case.
The defense did put on its case. What you're saying is we want to bolster the defense's case. Now, and the judge has the authority to keep out what in his estimation doesn't belong in there. And the standard that we have to apply to the judge's actions is a very deferential one.
The thing that I think, at least from my perspective, that seems to be missing is a connection between this particular person and this offense, right? Which is, based on what you've just said, it could be really anyone that meets that height and weight requirement that happens to live in the subdivision that may or may not have had scratches on their face at some point in the months before or after the offense occurred.
Well, around the time, Your Honor, of the offense. Leaves town, meets the description.
There is a constitutional right to travel.
Yes, Your Honor. But in our view of the law, and Holmes, Espinoza, Woolheater all emphasize the fact that you have to be able to present a complete defense. And the appellant in this case was denied that opportunity. He was also denied the opportunity to have expert assistance. In this case, he asked for Dr. Blake, so he was hemmed in on both sides by the judge. We asked for Dr. Blake. They wanted to do further DNA testing because they wanted to show there was a pattern of DNA in that house. They had a theory of defense, and the military judge did not allow them to present that defense. And that was also error.
Now, to what extent should we consider the following fact, though? The DNA from the semen found in the victim indicated that there was one perpetrator. That was Timothy Hennis. There was no other male DNA at that time. What was presented to the military judge at the time the military judge was deciding this was that there was no consensual sex between Hennis and the victim. That did not come up until closing argument. So when the military judge is considering that fact, where is this DNA evidence going to further the defense of Mr. Hennis?
Your Honor, I'm out of time.
Please answer the question.
Your Honor, the defense was fairly silent on their theory of the total defense. Their defense was it's a third party that committed these murders. This is a murder case. This wasn't a rape case. This wasn't a sexual assault case. This was a murder case, and they wanted to show there was a pattern of DNA throughout the home.
But what would that DNA have shown? What we've got is the military judge saying, it's on J2031, saying to Civilian Defense Counsel, and it's not a case of there being any consensual sex between the victim and Mr. Hennis. We then have the DNA evidence tying Mr. Hennis to the sex. If there is other male DNA evidence throughout this house, that's a rental house, where a number of first responders have been through there, what is that male DNA evidence going to demonstrate?
That male DNA evidence will demonstrate that if there is the same DNA in different rooms, that is more likely the perpetrator, because there was no other link to Timothy Hennis in this home of any forensic matter, or in his car, or in his home, that attached him to any murders in this case. So the defense wanted to show there's this, let's call him A's DNA in room one, A's DNA in room two, and A's DNA in room three, and in all those rooms, crimes were committed. Therefore, it's kind of a mapping of where a perpetrator was. That was their theory of defense. And they wanted Dr. Blake to be able to examine, have equal access to the evidence and examine those materials to determine, to do that mapping. And they were denied that by the military judge.
Was any effort made to, was any effort made to link the DNA under the victim's fingernails to any other DNA in the house?
There was efforts to, not to link to other people, Your Honor, not besides Timothy Hennis, according to our reading of the record. I will put you to footnote 114 in our brief. Our reading is there was no efforts to do the fingernail DNA. But the problem with the fingernail DNA was the degradation of it. It appears from the record that they couldn't do any testing on it. Now, the DNA test we've been talking about is just...
Would the speculative DNA strung around the house have been any different?
Your Honor, it may have been.
We don't know.
We don't know because the testing was never done. Their theory was that the perpetrator is in each room. And because the North Carolina police didn't investigate every room, and USA still had no... just did the testing in this case, that there was a gap in the evidence. They wanted to test to identify a different perpetrator.
Thank you.
One more issue. If there's any questions on the panel, I see I'm out of time.
Yeah. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Counsel, the court will take a
10-minute break.
The court will take a 10-minute break, and we will reconvene at 10:35.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.